Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Drew, how many Top Shots do you own?
Oh, well, how many are there now, right? There's a huge scarcity problem. So I think there's only five. So I think I own three of the five.
I'm going to be honest with you, and I think a lot of our listeners right now will be as informed about Top Shot as I am. I had heard about Top Shot kind of vaguely and casually over the last week or two, and it's this thing that's blown up hugely to where these virtual sports cards, which instead of a picture of a player with statistics on the back, you get a video highlight of a play, like a LeBron James dunk or a Steph Curry three-pointer. Drew, I can only tell you that this would feel so much like a scam, except that it's being sold directly to consumers by the National Basketball Association.
Right.
It's done like over $200 million in trading on this platform. That doesn't all go directly to the NBA. The NBA's only made a few million dollars off it, as far as I understand, directly. But then there's this secondary aftermarket. They're digital training cards. And when I first heard about it, tell me if this was your experience. When I first heard about it and I heard some people talking about it, I thought, well, wow. Okay, so this must be that somehow people are buying the rights, the intellectual property rights to highlights, and right, that somehow they're going to get royalties when these are played either on the internet or on TV or something. No, there's actually not even any exclusivity. Like, you can watch, I could go to YouTube and watch a clip of this digital Top Shot, but I don't actually own that Top Shot. Only the people who own the Top Shot own the Top Shot. And there's only a few hundred for any specific card. So it's like a trading card, but it's digital. But they don't actually own anything of it at all, because the image and the Top Shot itself is out there somewhere.
It's the value that's assigned to it is way beyond my understanding. And admittedly, I wasn't really much of like a collector. I'm not a collector of anything now.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to fully appreciate it, I guess. But I'm not getting how I wasn't in the same impression as you. I thought you'd be buying essentially the rights to this piece of media.
Yeah.
And so, you know, okay, at least I can wrap my head around that. I can at least, you know, someone really wants to see it, there's maybe a small fee, some kind of royalty, but that's not even the case.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It is bananas to me.
It is a really cool little graphic, and I haven't, I thought about trying to buy one, but apparently it's getting harder and harder to buy them. And people are lined up online to try to get a pack. So it's like old school trading cards where you can buy a pack, and then maybe you've got a special LeBron James dunk, like the one that sold for $208,000. $208,000 recently. And it's just this phenomenon of human beings when something is scarce and
right,
people say, yeah, hey, this is important or this is worthwhile, and enough people believe it, then all of a sudden it does have value, just like cryptocurrency. And you got to try not to think about it too hard. The funniest thing about all of this has been when Mark Cuban has been adamant. He said, hey, this is a real market. And his explanation for why it's a real market is, he says, hey, it's just like trading cards. To which my first response is like, yeah, trading cards are kind of BS too, except that because enough people think they're important, then they do have value, but it kind of fluctuates up and down depending on how many people think that it's a good investment versus how many people like them for their inherent beauty. Like, because I get this with at least with precious metals, with jewels, even with cryptocurrency to a certain degree. There is real scarcity there, right? And with precious metals, there's an appreciation of their beauty, and at least it's something tangible that you can hold. With cryptocurrency, there's
there's an intrinsic value for manufacturing and technology, and like there's applications that you can appreciate.
Yeah, with this, I just don't, because it's a graphic that you could easily. You can look at it on YouTube, and it's a really cool graphic. But as long as enough people, I guess the question is this some bubble where people at some point are going to lose interest? And when they lose interest, then a lot of that inherent value is gone? Or do you think that this will become just something that us olds don't understand, but the young kids like Mark Cuban just appreciate being able to keep a wallet full of these top shots?
It's already firmly in the olds don't understand column for me. So that ship has sailed. But the other question is, you know, like what's this going to do? And I feel like when I was reading this, it was like reminding me 2 weeks ago or, you know, 6 months ago, time has no meaning now. But when the GME story broke and, you know, you were looking at everything that was going on with Robinhood and that GME stock just blowing up and the manipulation involved.
What's
there.
That GameStop? GameStop's call sign GME. Okay.
Yeah. That's what the kids call it.
I wouldn't look too. I know me. And I knew that if I looked too far into the GameStop or any of those other things that I'd be buying it.
Go down the rabbit hole.
Load of GameStop. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, my brother has some. I mean, he was watching it like a hawk, but I mean, the thing that was, so weird about it is you're seeing something that is clearly like some, I'm not going to like to have a hot take on what aspect of the economy is broken that led to that, but something is like, you're watching it going, this something's broken here.
Well, it's,
I saw this story and I went like, you know, the NBA was like, oh, you thought that was broken? Watch this. And then they just like doubled down on every aspect of it. And I just feel like, you know, I don't know how long this can last. Are the players getting paid? Who's getting paid? How does this work? Like,
oh, yeah, I'm sure the players. Okay. So the players do get some. They've been gifted some of these. And then the players can sell them and keep all of the money that they make off of whichever ones they've sold. But, oh, that's the one part. That's the one part that I kind of get that this is interesting because it's on blockchain, and we'll get to blockchain in a minute. Yet one more thing I don't understand. We started last episode where I admitted that I didn't understand what meta means, and now we're just going further and further into things that I don't
Classic know. Sports podcast,
like,
yeah.
Like blockchain. So, okay, let's say LeBron James owns one of his own highlights on this Top Shot, and then he sells it. Because everything is very transparent, you can watch the chain of ownership, and because you always know, hey, there might be 200 of those out there, and these are the 200 people that own them. If you own the one that LeBron James previously owned, I'll admit that part of it. Now all of a sudden you've got scarcity. Like that's like that feels a little bit of cool. That's like the episode of Seinfeld when George was all excited because he thought he had John Voight's old LeBaron convertible.
But right, exactly. But is it that the players have the first right to purchase? Like, are they the ones? It doesn't work that way, right?
Not all of them. I think that's just a promotion they've done with a few of them. But then some players have gotten in on the trading too. So it might not be LeBron James. I don't know. It could be, hey, James Harden owned this Kevin Durant card at some point.
Right.
But you get this top, you know, when you're looking at it and you say like, oh crap, look at this. Look at it. Look how hard he used to own this. He looked at it. He was looking at it on his special jewel encrusted cell phone and everything.
Yeah. That's a great way to gauge just like how into each player is into their own highlights.
Yeah. Like how many, somebody's amassing all.
Yeah. Just like a top 10 list of like some of the guys you least suspect are only buying their own digital trading cards relentlessly.
And I'm trying not to be too critical of this. Cause honestly, if you start to really just step back and have perspective on all of it, anything with sports memorabilia is all based on this whole industry of sports in general, which is people wearing silly Lycra uniforms running around throwing balls at each other like that. None of that makes any sense. So it's all Yeah. What's more ridiculous? Why is one thing more ridiculous than the other?
Yeah, it's all just a real deep dive into what we value. Yeah.
And then if you want to get really deep, I mean, you can talk about like fiat currency and what we do when we went to the credit standard back in the day. We human beings have evolved to be able to believe in imaginary things. And that's been our strength as a species, is that you can actually rally millions of people around, you know, basically constructs, like the idea of patriotism and stuff like that. Those are all things that aren't necessarily tangible, but they're real in our minds, and you can rally people around that.
Yeah, and nothing so far bad has happened around that. I mean,
not a single thing.
I think that's a hot take, and I like it.
That's not even a take. That's just a description.
It's just a fact.
No. What I'm describing is just a description of the way human brains work. You know, right. That's how, like, back in the days, there was it calorie shells or something. One society had just these little shells. It was one of the first forms of fiat currency where it said, like, hey, this shell is worth 10 pounds of rice.
Right.
And, but as long as you just have this shell, then such and such. And that's this, it's, and then it turned into like, hey, this dollar is worth X amount of gold and whatnot. And then we just kept going from there. But you're right that our ability to believe in things, whether they be various deities or anything else, it can be corrupted and it can turn really ugly. Well, I worry about somebody that's like cashing in their 401k for a Top Shot.
Yeah. And it's, there will be a headline just like that, guaranteed.
I thought, one of the best lessons I ever learned was that I got my first big contract, or my first renegotiated contract, in 1999, which was at the height of the first dot-com bubble. And, you know, if you didn't own Perfumania and Cisco, you're a damn fool. And yeah. I was heavy. I went heavy, heavy tech. And then, you know, the bubble burst. Luckily, I was young enough in my career that I learned my lesson. And like all these internet companies that had no inherent value. They were all just promises. And they were selling it infinity profit to earnings ratios. Or PE ratios. So price to earnings ratios. So
I'm pretending to know all most of these words, so just keep going.
Anyway, I've been through that, and I worry about any time anybody gets too sucked into this. And look, Drew, I'm a little bit older than you. The first time trading cards were huge back in the 1980s, I mean, you'd have this little book. You'd get these magazines every month or these price guides that would show you, oh, hey,
yeah,
this Pete Rose is worth $57. And then you'd go into the card shop with your Pete Rose and you'd say, sir, can I please have my $57? And you're like, no, that's not what they're, but all these trading card companies were just pumping up the value of all these cards. And it created this hysteria to where, you know, grown men investment funds were created around trading cards, and then eventually people realized, oh, there's no inherent value in these things, and they're just overproduced like crazy. I think that the Top Shot people understand that part of it. Obviously, I mean, they're pretty savvy people. I wonder what happens when more companies get in on it, when it's not just Top Shot.
This is through the NBA. Well, they can't though, right? Yeah, it's right, through the right. league. That's the yeah. thing. Like that's yeah. why it's, that's why this is so interesting to me. Is
so they'll be able to maintain scarcity,
right? Yeah. Well, they can. I mean, they just have the ability to manage the media itself and all the rights associated with every single highlight. I'm sure. It's man. I grew up not being a collector, not being into trading cards. The only trading card I ever had, and I'm not a baseball guy, but being from the Bay Area, I had a dog growing up, and this is going somewhere. And this dog used to get out relentlessly. It would jump over the fence. And we had this awesome neighbor, would always grab the dog because it was always in its yard, running around, would bring it over. Just a really nice, like a younger couple. I was probably like 8 or 9 at the time. And one day he comes over, and I can see immediately, even as a kid, that this guy is devastated. And he's like, look, I'm so sorry. I got to talk to you and your mom. And he explains that the dog got out and he was backing out of his driveway and he ran over our dog and the dog killed the dog. And I mean, this guy is just, torn apart, understandably. And he's just apologizing relentlessly. He's like, look, I'd love to have you over, cook you guys dinner, just, you know, try to make amends with you guys. I'm so sorry. And he goes into this guy, I realize, is a diehard collector. This guy has, he's a huge Oakland A's fan. And back then, I mean, this was like 89 earthquake era when they were having the World Series there. And he goes back there and he comes back, we're having dinner. And he goes, I just want to give you something. I mean, it's the least I can do to try to make amends with you guys. And it's a signed baseball from the Bash Brothers, Jose Canseco and Mark McGwire, and a card, like a limited edition card that he had in this like beautiful case. It's all signed by him. He's like, I just want you to have this. And so he gives it to me, and I have no idea the value of whatever this is. And even now, I'm not really sure, you know, I assume that it would have gone for a lot. Gives it to me. And also, if you're about to look up that it's worth like $1 million, please, please let me tell you where the story is going.
Yeah.
And then don't share this.
Okay.
And he gives it to me. And I, you know, I put it in my room. It sits on my shelf for however many years, like, you know, getting into like probably my sophomore, junior high school. And I remember at the time, we grew up very modest background. I had no money and I was trying to figure out a way. I'm like, well, I don't have a job. That's too complicated. Getting a job is complicated. So what do I have? I grab the thing off the shelf and I ride my bike down to a pawn shop and I pawn it for, I think, $25.
Yeah.
So that was the end of that.
I'm looking. Don't worry. I won't depress you too much. There's so many different cards with Bash Brothers on it. That was probably, I'm gonna for the sake of your own, I think you got one over on the pawn shop by selling it for $25.
No way. Really?
I don't know. It's because, look, there are so many special edition things floating around out there.
Yeah, right. It's kind of one of those things where the market got flooded by a bunch of, like, they saw the hot card. And
yeah, that probably was some fly-by-night operation. You're cool. I don't think it's
fly-by-night. Some guy back there just counterfeiting
some,
cards.
Some dog-killing dude. Now, if it turned out that guy was like a serial killer or something that sold it to you, but you wouldn't be able to...
Well, look,
you
wouldn't Seth, be able to, I'm sorry I didn't up the ante with... a serial killer anecdote story.
Well, no. I'm saying like, because if it were something like that, like with this blockchain thing with the Top Shots where you've got a story behind the previous ownership, maybe there's something then.
Right.
So
right.
That was the other question I had
where
for
I'm
you.
Going with it. And that guy was Ted Bundy.
Okay. So do you know what blockchain is?
I know it enough to probably, like most people, I know enough to poorly explain it to someone else that knows less.
Okay. We're going to do, okay.
We'll so I understand blockchain. That there's like a running algorithm, I guess, that you need to generate, you know, whatever it is, the currency, and the more times you do it, the longer it takes to generate it, creating,
I think
more work.
I think that's a little different because that's what Bitcoin and everything. That's how they generate the Bitcoins. But with the blockchain, they run that on a blockchain format, but that's to keep track of everything. But I think that's different than the blockchain itself.
Got it.
The blockchain just keeps, I don't have a damn clue.
I'm embarrassed that I just invested in it.
We're too full. We're too far off. We are. We're too far out of our wheelhouse. Let's go to football. I was reading Houston columnist John McClain. Houston sports writer John McClain's mailbag on Friday. And I was really interested in answering one of these questions that John got. I want you to answer it. This is the question. I've wondered about the makeup of an offensive line. A few points. One, edge rushers are picked for speed, strength, and physical ability. Most of the good ones are not 300 plus pounds. Why are the offensive tackles that need to deal with them picked for height and weight? I would think quickness and strength would be key. For example, collegiate offensive guards are 6'3 or less, 290-pound gym rats. Edge rushers would never be able to get underneath and around them. Instead, they would get under the edge rushers, probably under their shoulder pads, and push them up off their feet. Well, that's a pretty ambitious... maybe they'd have it at level. Like, every single one...
Okay.
If they're 6'2", they'd push them off of their feet.
They just lift them right off their feet. Got it. Just easy, guys.
So this is a basic question about, all right, offensive tackles have, I think even increasingly so, become like centers in basketball where height is just of paramount importance. Have they overdone it with the offensive tackles?
I mean, I think so. You know, I mean, I even remember, you may not recall some of the guys, when we got to Houston, I mean, we had a couple guys that were all Pac-12 players. They had been there. There were a couple that, you know, were with me at all-star games coming out of college, and they were like Lightbody and some other guys that were like, I mean, they were 6'7".
Yeah.
You know, and it's hard to be effective at that length. And I don't think they ever got away from it. But coaches love thinking about how they can just literally create space between the quarterback and the rusher by just having someone with longer arms at the point of attack.
Somebody with a huge radius.
Yeah. Just the ability to cover more ground without trying.
This is how I would answer the question. It's that, yes, you have a point that you want guys who are just flat out good football players. I would argue that this guy asking the question goes a little too far in the other direction where he's saying it'd be an advantage to be above 6'3". This is what I tell you. From personal experience, when you're trying to rush against a really good offensive tackle who's 6'7" or taller, is that, and I'm not talking to you, Drew, you know this, but I would say the person asking the question, you feel like a little child when that guy is that big and can actually move and has some strength and can use leverage and everything. You just can't get into him. So, yeah, you can be, I mean, if you're Dwight Freeney, that's one thing. It's like Dwight Freeney, not a really tall guy, but it was just so blisteringly fast that it didn't matter. But for a lot of those guys, they have such a length advantage that unless you're 6'7" yourself, it's hard to overcome it. And then what I would also say is that if you are, say, a 6'2" offensive tackle, you better be damn strong and athletic to be able to overcome those 6'5" and 6'6" defensive ends who can long arm you all day long, you know, who can do the same thing that those offensive tackles we were talking about can do. And, but now those are all, that's when you're talking about guys who actually have the ability to do it. What coaches have done though, is they'll look at a guy like a Jonathan Ogden and say, wow, look at how much his length helps him.
Yep.
I'm going to take this other 6'8" guy who's not athletic at all and not strong and not all that mean, and I'm going to let him play in the NFL for 6 or 7 years. Well, because I, the football coach, am so good at developing talent that someday he's going to be an all-pro. Just you wait.
And that's it. I mean, I think you just summed it up perfectly. That's exactly right. It's that they're focusing on the wrong traits.
Yeah.
And, you know, when those traits all align perfectly, I mean, yeah, you're getting a Pro Bowler. That's what you're getting. But those guys are so, so rare. And it's not always that, just like you said, I mean, it's kind of like the hubris
of
a lot of these position coaches that think they can turn all those guys into another Ogden or another Pro Bowler like that. It's exceedingly rare. I think that they're, in doing that, they're overlooking a lot of guys who had all the other traits, all the other abilities.
Right.
And missing out on the fact that, like, sure. Yeah. What that length does, and it does this in a lot of other different skill positions. You'd probably defensive tackle, I assume. I mean, some of the guys who are just like anchor type guys who can't be moved. I mean, even in the event they're making mistakes, the offensive linemen who have that length, the margin of error just becomes greater. Right. You're assisted by geometry. Like when you do screw up, you have the benefit of the geometry to help you a little bit. And that's that's what I think a lot of coaches really like, is that in the event that there's a mistake, that they have bad footwork, at the very least, they're harder to get around.
Right. Right.
And that's how they look at it. Well, I think what you want are the guys who don't make mistakes.
Yeah.
And who are also athletic.
Well, that's where I have a little bit of an issue with the guy where he goes too far, where he says, talking about 6'3", 290-pound gym rat guards. Guy, it's almost like, hey, any of these college guards would be awesome NFL offensive tackles. Yeah. For every guy like that, there's somebody in the NFL who's much stronger, much faster. Yeah. Exact same body dimensions, but much stronger, much faster, all of those things. But when he says that edge rushers would never be able to get underneath and around them, well, that's just false. They would be able to get unless they're more athletic, and they don't have to get underneath them usually, except in the run game. Yep. But that is, there are a lot of tall guys who get taken advantage of because they just don't have good leverage. And also when you watch those college offensive linemen, so many of them, man, with like every, and including guys that get taken in the first round and eventually are going to be good, their pad level just sucks.
It does.
You know, compared to what they're going to have to do in the NFL, you can just watch a college offensive lineman and say, "Oh boy, this kid's going to get his ass whooped early until he figures this out."
Yep.
So one of the other things you said was two of the best offensive linemen I can remember, or offensive lines I can remember, had Nate Newton and Larry Allen at guard. Why are the guards the huge people movers? Larry Allen played both guard and tackle. So, I mean, Larry Allen could just do whatever the hell he wanted. Why are guards the huge people movers? I mean, a lot of that is just simply because to go back to the geometry again, it's just that inside in there, there's a lot less room to move, and it's more about strength. Your strength can help you more on the inside. Your athleticism can help you more on the outside.
Well, it's that, but it's also obviously the center is going to be, you know, at the first point of attack.
Yeah,
you know, just by virtue of the fact that they're going to be right on top of the guy because of the line of scrimmage. The guards have the benefit of at least gaining generally a head of steam, you know, before. They're going to be a little further off the ball. They can get 1 to 2 steps in before they make contact sometimes. So you're going to have a guy who's going to be more stout at the point of attack, usually going against most teams that like to run heavier guys inside. So you're naturally going to have the guys who are skilled at, you know, trying to create movement, you know, on the interior side. I mean, that's just like the nature of it. It's only the, you know, the rare teams that like to run, you know, I mean, most people reference kind of the Broncos during, you know, the Shanahan era, where they like the smaller guys, you know, the more undersized, quick technicians who are more playing angles than anything else and not trying to get guys downfield.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting, you know, and
And I'm totally for, honestly, I do think, that a lot of NFL coaches underestimate guys who are shorter, overestimate guys who are taller, and there's a lot of room for some of these guys. It becomes a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy when you look in the NFL and you see all these offensive linemen. You say, well, look, all the tackles are 6'7". Well, yeah, because those are the guys you're drafting in the first and second rounds.
Yeah, exactly.
The guys that are 6'4" are getting moved down to guard, and because that's what everybody believes, that's where you go. So,
well, that's why, I mean, you just look at how many guys, I mean, that you played with, Seth, and then some of the best guys I imagine that you played against during your career, that you knew they were offensive linemen that were just, you know, 6'4", 6'5".
Yeah.
And drafted in later rounds.
Right.
And they hung on and played for 10 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that, I feel like that's by far and away, you know, the more common occurrence. And so it's offensive line specifically. It's interesting how that works.
It's just harder to project, I guess. And it's harder to, guys are afraid to do anything that it's easy to afterwards say, wow, why did you make that move? Obviously the guy was going to suck. He's 6'4".
Exactly. It's protecting liability. I mean, the coaches so desperately want to assign some kind of value, some kind of metrics to those linemen when they're at the combine. They love, you know, I one of the examples I remember, which is more of my era, was Robert Gallery when he was coming out of Iowa.
Yeah, he's the perfect example.
Loved watching him run 40s and hit all the tests. And he was good. I mean, he was still okay. He wasn't as bad as a lot of people, I think, thought he was. I mean,
he was just fine. A letdown because he was ballyhooed as this incredible next big thing.
Exactly, because he's so huge.
Yeah.
You know? And at the end of the day, it's, you know, how effective are you at stopping, you know, a speed rusher?
The one that always gets me was Jose Altuve in baseball, because Altuve was for a long time, and I think there's either him or Tony Kemp are vying for shortest guy in Major League Baseball. But it always make me chuckle that Jose Altuve was the shortest guy in baseball and one of the very best in baseball. And that's what it took for a guy who is 5'5" to make it in Major League Baseball. Like, okay,
right.
Presumably it's not just coincidence that the guy who's 5'5" in the like is the only guy that could have played in the major leagues.
Yes.
That's how good he had to be. I mean, the first day he went to camp in Venezuela for the Astros, the camp they had down there, the Astros sent him home. He had to come back the next day and kind of keep knocking at the door before they even looked at him. So, I don't know what you do about it other than, you know, ask football coaches to stop being susceptible.
Well, I mean, there are so many defensive tackles too on the other side of the ball that were the same way. I remember tons of so many nose guards that were like that. I mean,
That are 6 foot tall and just impossible to
move. Yes, impossible to move, but very athletic. extremely athletic, really quick.
That's why I was surprised that Aaron Donald didn't get somehow screwed over in the draft. I thought I could have seen him falling into the top of the second round because he was too short or something. Daniel Jeremiah had tweeted out this. I thought it was interesting. He said, we're 2 to 3 years away from personnel departments not caring about 40 times. The game GPS data is going to replace it. Who cares what he ran in the 40? I know exactly what he ran in game conditions, and I have 5 years of data for context. Yes, that's all awesome. That's all true. Where I'm a little confused about that is the Daniel Jeremiah was a scout forever. And all these scouts will always tell you, well, nobody really cares too much about 40 time. And yet they will gush and gush and gush over guys 40 times. Everybody knows it's stupid. Everybody knows it's dumb. Everybody knows that there's hardly ever a situation in football where you're running 40 yards unimpeded the entire time in a straight line. And yet they can't break themselves of that addiction. Same as the 225 test at the combine. You know, like every year there's some guy that benches 40 plus on the 225 test and people gush and gush about it. But then the very next comment will be, has short arms, struggles with short arms.
Like, right.
Right. He's not that strong on the football field. There are guys out there that can bench 225 20 times that are incredibly strong on the football field. It's just they're at a natural disadvantage because they've got freakishly long arms.
Yeah. The lineman on the inside that's a phenomenal example of that. I mean, so many D linemen, tons of O linemen were just horrendous at the bench test.
Yeah.
Horrendous.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But awesome on the field. Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about that a couple episodes ago about how dumb an exercise the bench press is. If you think about how much time and energy you spent in your life as a young man trying to get your bench up, what it could have been better spent on.
As a guy who obsessed over it personally, for sure.
Like if you could have just gone out and done some more pass sets, would have benefited you more than doing all those bench presses. So, okay, then we're in agreement. Yeah, there should be an avenue for shorter offensive linemen, but not to the degree where I want every 6'3", 290-pound guard from college to come be an NFL offensive tackle.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I like the entirety of that comment. That was great. It was actually pretty informed. But that little section right there is definitely it's underestimating just how many guards are out there that are not like that. They're also bigger and really athletic. I, as a 6'3", 290 guy, I'm like right in my sweet spot, man. Like
I think that
all day, every day. But
it's hard. I think some people don't realize how big the difference is between college and the NFL and what freak shows the guys are in the NFL. So when you're watching two teams playing the Big 12 and you see some kid dominating, you think, he's got all that it takes. And he gets in the NFL and he's just a guy, you know? And I think you and I both had a chip on our shoulder when it came to a lot of stuff like that. Cause you get some first round draft pick that thinks because he was all Big 10 that he's the crap. And you just love to beat those guys into the dirt.
Yeah. I try to sum it up for people where I'm just like, if there's, you know, three sort of aspects that make up a player, you know, and how impressive they are or what it is that really, you know, makes them successful at the college level. And it's like just general athletic ability, speed, and then power or strength, you know, especially like with the guys inside the box. You know, you just think like at the college level, some of the guys can do really well. They'll make all conference, they'll get awards, they'll get some recognition, and they only really have to be very fast or really strong in some measure of athleticism. Like if they just have one of those and they're exceedingly, you know, a standout in one of those, they'll be great. In the NFL, the vast majority of the time, they're both really fast, really strong, and probably really athletic.
Yeah.
So they have all the traits just like dialed up, you know, and in college, you're just rarely going against one guy who has all of those traits, you know, summed up into one person, one player who can just excel like that. So it's like, there were only a handful of guys I remember all through college where I was like, yeah, that guy just kind of has all the things going right now, you know? Yeah, and then in the NFL, you're just like, hopefully a backup comes in because it'd be good to go just against a power guy again. That'd be awesome. I'm pretty exhausted by these guys that are both fast and lifting me.
which is probably a pretty good prelude to some of the draft talk we'll have coming up in the next couple months. I'm going to pick your brain about some of these offensive linemen. I got to go run and see who else the Texans are going to shed from the roster today. And let me offer you my condolences for your dog from 30 years ago.
Yeah, thanks. I'm sure they're living on a state upstate New York somewhere.
Hang in there, sport.